Afterward. Questions I am often asked. Frankly, I've always been embarrassed by personal questions like some in this afterward. But I am asked them so often and with such sincere interest that I've gone ahead and included them here. First question. The Seven Habits was published in 1989. Given your experiences in the many years that have followed, what would you change, add, or subtract? I am not responding lightly, but frankly, I wouldn't change anything. I might go deeper and apply wider, but I've had the opportunity to do that in some of the books released since then. For example, over 250,000 individuals were profiled, showing Habit 3 put first things first as the habit most neglected. So the First Things First book, which was published in 1996, went deeper into Habits 2 and 3, but also added more substance and illustrations for all of the other habits. The Seven Habits of Highly Effective Families applied the Seven Habits framework of thinking into building strong, happy, highly effective families. Also, my son Sean applied the framework to the unique needs, interests, and challenges of teens in a very visually attractive, entertaining, and edifying way in the Seven Habits of Highly Effective Teens. We have also had tens of thousands of people tell us of the significant impact of becoming the creative force of their own lives through internalizing the Seven Habits. 76 of them shared the details of their fascinating stories of courage and inspiration in living the Seven Habits, showing the transforming power of the principles in all kinds of personal, family, and organizational settings, regardless of their circumstances, organizational position, or prior life experiences. Second question. What have you learned about the Seven Habits since the book's release? I have learned or had reinforced many things. Let me briefly mention 10 learnings. First, the importance of understanding the difference between principles and values. Principles are natural laws that are external to us and that ultimately control the consequences of our actions. Values are internal and subjective and represent that which we feel strongest about in guiding our behavior. Hopefully, we will come to value principles so that we get the results we want now in a way that enables us to get even greater results in the future, which is how I define effectiveness. Everyone has values. Even criminal gangs have values. Values govern people's behavior, but principles govern the consequences of those behaviors. Principles are independent of us. They operate regardless of our awareness of them, acceptance of them, liking of them, belief in them, or obeying them. I have come to believe that humility is the mother of all virtues. Humility says we are not in control. Principles are in control. Therefore, we submit ourselves to principles. Pride, the opposite of humility, says that we are in control, and since our values govern our behavior, we can simply do life our way. We might do so, but the consequences of our behavior flow from principles, not our values. Therefore, we should value principles. Second learning. From experiences all over the world with this material, I have come to see the universal nature of the principles undergirding this material. Illustrations and practices may vary and are culturally specific, but the principles are the same. I have found the principles contained in the Seven Habits in all six major world religions, and have actually drawn upon quotations from sacred writings of those religions when teaching in those cultures. I have done this in the Middle East, India, all around Asia, Australia and South Pacific, South America, Europe, North America, Africa, and among the Native Americans and other indigenous peoples. Men and women alike face similar problems, have similar needs, and internally resonate with the underlying principles. There is an internal sense of the principle of justice, or win-win. There is an internal moral sense of the principle of responsibility, of the principle of purpose, of integrity, of respect, of cooperation, of communication, of renewal. These are universal. But practices are not. They are situationally specific. Every culture interprets universal principles in unique ways. Third learning. I have come to see the organizational implications of the seven habits. Although in the strict technical sense, an organization does not have habits. Its culture has norms or mores or social codes which represent habits. An organization also has established systems, processes, and procedures. These represent habits. In fact, in the last analysis, all behavior is personal. It is individual, even though it often is part of a collective behavior in the form of decisions made by management regarding structure and systems, processes, and practices. We have worked with thousands and thousands of organizations in most every industry and profession, and have found that the same basic principles contained in the seven habits apply and define effectiveness. Fourth learning. You can teach all seven habits by starting with any one habit. And you can also teach one habit in a way that leads to the teaching of the other six. It's like a hologram, where the whole is contained in the part, and the part is contained in the whole. Fifth learning. Even though the seven habits represent an inside-out approach, it works most successfully when you start with the outside challenge and then take the inside-out approach. In other words, if you are having a relationship challenge, say a breakdown of communication and trust, this will define the nature of the needed inside-out approach in winning the kind of private victory that enables the public victory that will meet that challenge. This is the reason I often teach habits 4, 5, and 6 before I teach habits 1, 2, and 3. In other words, you start with the public challenge, then the private victory leading to the public victory in meeting that challenge. Sixth learning. Interdependence is 10 times more difficult than independence. It demands so much more mental and emotional independence to think win-win, when another person is into win-lose, to seek to understand first, when everything inside you cries out for understanding, and to search for a better third alternative when compromise is so much easier. In other words, to work successfully with others in creative, cooperative ways requires an enormous amount of independence, internal security, and self-mastery. Otherwise, what we call interdependency is really counterdependency, where people do the opposite to assert their independence. Or we sometimes call it codependency, where they literally need the other person's weakness to fulfill their need and to justify their own weakness. Seventh learning. You can pretty well summarize the first three habits with the expression, make and keep a promise. And you can pretty well summarize the next three habits with the expression, involve others in the problem and work out the solution together. Eighth learning. The seven habits represents a new language, even though there are less than a dozen unique words or phrases in it. This new language becomes a code, a shorthand way of saying a great deal. When you say to another, was that a deposit or a withdrawal? Or you may say, is that reactive or proactive? Or you may say, is that synergistic or a compromise? Or you might say, is that win-win or win-lose or lose-win? You might say, is that putting first things first or second things first? Or you might say, is that beginning with the means in mind or the end in mind? I've seen entire cultures transformed by a wide understanding of and commitment to the principles and concepts symbolized by these very special code words. The heart of culture is language. Ninth learning. Integrity is a higher value than loyalty. Or perhaps better put, integrity is the highest form of loyalty. Integrity means being integrated or centered on principles, not on people, organizations, or even family. You will find that the root of most issues that people are dealing with is this. Is it popular? That is it acceptable? Is it political? Or is it right? When we prioritize being loyal to a person or group over doing what we feel to be right, we lose integrity. We may temporarily gain popularity or build loyalty, but downstream, this loss of integrity will undermine even those relationships. It's like bad-mouthing someone behind their back. The person you are temporarily united with through bad-mouthing someone else knows that you would bad-mouth them under different pressures and circumstances. In a sense, the first three habits represent integrity, and the next three, loyalty, but they are totally interwoven. Over time, integrity produces loyalty. If you attempt to reverse them and go for loyalty first, you will find yourself temporizing and compromising integrity. Remember, it is better to be trusted than to be liked. Ultimately, you will find that trust and respect will generally produce love. Tenth learning. Living the seven habits is a constant struggle for everyone. Everyone falters from time to time on each of the seven, and sometimes all seven simultaneously. They really are simple to understand, but difficult to consistently practice. They are common sense, but remember, what is common sense is not usually common practice. Third question frequently asked me, which habit do you personally have the greatest difficulty with? Habit 5. When I am really tired and already convinced that I'm right, I really don't want to listen. I may even pretend to listen. Basically, I am guilty of the same thing I talk about, listening with the intent to reply, not to understand. In fact, in some sense, I struggle almost daily with all of the seven habits. I have conquered none of them. I see them more as life principles that we never really master, and that the closer we come to such a mastery, we become more aware of how really far we have yet to go. It's like the more you know you don't know. This is why I often gave my university students 50% of the grade for the quality of their questions, and the other 50% for the quality of their answers to their questions. The true level of knowledge is better revealed that way. You cannot ask a question outside your field of knowledge. That's why a person's question reveals the level of their understanding and their knowledge more than their answer to some other question. Similarly, the seven habits represents an upward cycle, like an ever-enlarging spiral staircase. Habit 1 at a high level is vastly different than Habit 1 at a lower level. To be proactive at the beginning level may only be awareness of the space between stimulus and response. At the next level, it may involve a choice, such as not to get back or to get even. At the next level, to give feedback. At the next level, to ask forgiveness. At the next level, to forgive. At the next, to forgive parents. At the next, to forgive dead parents. And the next level, to simply not take offense initially. Fourth question. You're the vice chairman of Franklin Covey Company. Does Franklin Covey live the habits? We try to. We continually are striving to live what we teach. It's our most fundamental value. But we know we don't do it perfectly. Like any other business, we're challenged by changing market realities and by integrating the two cultures of the former Covey Leadership Center and Franklin Quest. The merger took place in the summer of 1997. It takes time, patience, and persistence in applying the principles, and the true test of our success will be in the long run. No snapshot will give an accurate picture. Any airplane is off track much of the time, but it just keeps coming back to the flight plan. Eventually, it arrives at its destination. This is true with all of us as individuals, families, or organizations. The key is to have an end in mind and a shared commitment to constant feedback and constant course correction. Fifth question. Why 7? Why not 6 or 8 or 10 or 15? What's so sacred about 7? Nothing is sacred about 7. It just so happens that the three private victory habits, that is, freedom to choose, the nature of the choice, and the action based on that choice, precede the three public victory habits: respect, understanding, and creative cooperation. And then there is one to renew the rest, and that equals 7. When asked this question, I have often said, if there were some other desirable characteristic you would like to make into a habit, you would simply put that under habit 2 as one of the values you're trying to live by. In other words, if punctuality is a desirable trait you want to make a habit, that would be one of the values of habit 2. So no matter what else you come up with, you would put it under habit 2, your value system. Habit 1 is the idea that you can have a value system, that you can choose your own value system. Habit 2 is what those choices or values are. And habit 3 is to live by them. So they are very basic, generic, and interconnected. It so happens that at the writing of this afterword for this new edition of The 7 Habits, I have just completed a new book entitled The 8th Habit, with the subtitle From Effectiveness to Greatness. To some, calling it The 8th Habit may appear to be a departure from my standard answer. But you see, as I say in the opening chapter of this new book, the world has profoundly changed since The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People was published in 1989. The challenges and complexity we face in our personal lives and relationships, in our families, in our professional lives, and in our organizations are of a different order of magnitude. In fact, are different in kind. Many mark 1989, the year we witnessed the fall of the Berlin Wall, as the beginning of the information age, the birth of a new reality, a sea change of incredible significance. Truly, a new era. Being highly effective as individuals and organizations is no longer optional in today's world. It is the price of entry to the playing field. But surviving, thriving, innovating, excelling, and leading in this new reality will require us to build on and reach beyond effectiveness. The call and need of a new era is for fulfillment. It's for passionate optimization, for significant contribution and greatness. These are on a different plane or dimension. They are different in kind, just as significance is different in kind, not in degree, from success. Tapping into the higher reaches of human genius and motivation, what we could call voice, requires a new mindset, a new skill set, a new tool set, a new habit. This is why we often call the information age the age of the knowledge worker. The 8th habit, then, is not about adding one more habit to the 7, one that somehow got forgotten. It's about seeing and harnessing the power of a third dimension to all the 7 habits that meets the central challenge of the new knowledge worker age. Sixth question. How does notoriety affect you? It affects me in different ways. From an ego standpoint, it's flattering. From a teaching standpoint, it's humbling. But I must strongly acknowledge that I am not the author of any of these principles and deserve absolutely no recognition. I am not saying this because of a desire to be modest and humble. I am saying this because I believe it, that I, myself, believe it. I see myself, like most of you, as a seeker of truth, of understanding. I am not a guru. I disdain being called a guru. I want no disciples. I am only trying to promote a discipleship toward principles that are already in people's hearts, that people will live true to their conscience. Seventh question. If you had to do it over again, what is the one thing you would do differently as a business person? I would do more strategic, proactive recruiting and selecting. When you are buried by the urgent and have 1,000 balls in the air, it is so easy to put people that appear to have solutions into key positions. The tendency is not to look deeply into their backgrounds and patterns, to do due diligence, nor to carefully develop the criteria that needs to be met in the particular roles or assignments. I am convinced that when recruiting and selecting is done strategically, that is, thinking long-term and proactively, not based upon the pressures of the moment, it pays enormous long-term dividends. Someone once said, "That which we desire most earnestly, we believe most easily." You really have to look deeply into both character and competence, because eventually downstream, flaws in either area will manifest themselves in both areas. I am convinced that although training and development is important, recruiting and selection and placement are much more important. It's foundational to the knowledge worker economy. Eighth question. If you had to do it over again, what is the one thing you would do differently as a parent? As a parent, I wish I had spent more time in carefully developing soft, informal, win-win agreements with each of my children in the different phases of their lives. Because of business and travels, I often indulged my children and went for lose-win too much, instead of paying the price in relationship building sufficient to really develop thorough, sound, win-win agreements more consistently. Ninth question. How is technology going to change business in the future? I believe in Stan Davis's statement that when the infrastructure changes, everything rumbles. And I think the technical infrastructure is central to everything. It will accelerate all good and bad trends. I'm also convinced that it is for those very reasons that the human element becomes even more important. High tech without high touch does not work. And the more influential technology becomes, the more important the human factor which controls that technology becomes, particularly in developing a cultural commitment to the criteria in the use of that technology. Just as the body is a good servant but a bad master, technology is a good servant but a bad master. Tenth question. Are you surprised or astounded at the universal popularity of the seven habits with other countries and cultures, ages and genders and so forth? My answer is yes and no. Yes, in that I had no idea it would become a worldwide phenomenon and that a few of the words would be part of Americana. No, in the sense that the material had been tested for over 25 years, and I knew that it would work primarily because it is based upon principles which I did not invent and therefore take no credit for. 11th question. How would you begin to teach the seven habits to very young children? My answer is, I think I would live by Albert Schweitzer's three basic rules for raising children. First, example. Second, example. Third, example. But I wouldn't go quite that far. I would say first, example. Second, build a caring and affirming relationship. And third, teach some of the simple ideas underlying the habits in the language of children. Help them gain a basic understanding and vocabulary of the seven habits and show them how to process their own experiences through the principles. Let them identify what particular principles and habits are being illustrated in their lives. 12th question. My boss, or spouse, or child, or friend, or whoever, really needs the seven habits. How would you recommend I get them to read it? People don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. Therefore, build a relationship of trust and openness based upon a character example of trustworthiness, and then share how the seven habits have helped you. Simply let them see the seven habits in action through your life. Then, at an appropriate time, you might invite them to participate in a training program or share your book as a gift or teach some of the basic ideas when the occasion calls for it. Question 13. What is your background and how did you come to write the seven habits? It was implicitly understood that I would follow in my father's footsteps and go into the family business. However, I found that I enjoyed teaching and training leaders even more than business. I became deeply interested and involved in the human side of organizations when I was at the Harvard Business School. Later, I taught business subjects at Brigham Young University and did consulting, advising, and training on the side for several years. During that time, I became interested in creating integrated leadership and management development programs around a sequential and balanced set of principles. These eventually evolved into the seven habits, and then while applying it to organizations, it evolved into the concept of principle-centered leadership. I decided to leave the university and go full-time into training executives from all different kinds of organizations. After a year of following a very carefully developed curriculum, came the development of a business that has enabled us to take the material to people throughout the world. Question 14. What is your response to the people who claim to have the true formula for success? I would say two things. First, if what they are saying is based on principles or natural laws, I would want to learn from them, and I commend them. Second, I would say we are probably using different words to describe the same basic principles or natural laws. Question 15. Are you really bald, or do you shave your head for efficiency's sake? Hey, listen, while you're busy blow-drying your hair, I'm out serving my customers. In fact, the first time I heard the expression, bald is beautiful, I kicked the slats out of my crib. One final word. My strongest motivation, desire, and wish is that we will all live principle-centered lives and attempt to build principles into our relationships, into our families, and into our communities. In the last analysis, principles govern. That is why humility is the mother of all virtues, and courage the father. Remember the beautiful couplet, I sought my God, and my God I could not find. I sought my soul, and my soul eluded me. I sought to serve my brother in his need, and I found all three, my God, my soul, and thee.